From the floor of the House of Representatives here in the United States Capitol Building in Washington, D.C., we present the annual State of the Union message by the President of the United States to a joint session of Congress. President Eisenhower is expected in just a moment. Presiding at this joint session of Congress are the President of the Senate, who is the Vice President of the United States, Richard M. Nixon, and the Speaker of the House of Representatives on your right, Congressman Sam Rayburn, Democrat of Texas. Joining the members of Congress for this joint session are the various members of the President's Cabinet, whom you're looking at now, the Supreme Court of the United States, the Diplomatic Corps, including ambassadors from all points on the globe, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States Armed Forces. The President has arrived here at the Capitol Building and will be entering the chamber in just a moment or two. He'll be announced to the joint session by the doorkeeper of the House, William M. Miller. Today's State of the Union address will be the eighth presented by President Eisenhower, all of which have been delivered in person, excepting for 1956, when the chief executive was convalescing from his heart attack. In the galleries, packed with spectators, are Mrs. Eisenhower and Mrs. Nixon, and there are many other distinguished guests on hand. Eight senators and representatives will escort the president from the door to the podium. From the House are the Majority Leader McCormick of Massachusetts, Democrat Albert from Oklahoma, and the Republican Minority Leader Halleck. Now, the announcement of the President.
United States.
From the Senate, escorting the President to the rostrum, the Majority Leader Johnson of Texas and Democrats Mansfield of Montana and Hennings of Missouri. For the Republicans, their leader Dirksen of Illinois and Kuchel of California, the whip. As the president walks towards the podium, Democrats and Republicans alike stand and applaud. Democrats were on the president's left as he walked down the aisle. Presenting the president will be Speaker Rayburn.
Members of the Congress, I have the great pleasure and the high privilege of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the 86th Congress, and friends. 7 years ago, I entered my present office with one long-held resolve overriding all others. I was then, and remain now, determined that the United States shall become an ever more potent resource for the cause of peace. Realizing that peace cannot be for ourselves alone, but for peoples everywhere. This determination is, I know, shared by the entire Congress, indeed by all Americans. My purpose today is to discuss some features of America's position, both at home and in her relations to others. First, I point out that, for us, annual self-examination is made a necessity by the fact that we live in a divided world of uneasy equilibrium, with our side committed to its own protection and against aggression by the other. With both sections of this divided world in possession of unbelievably destructive weapons, mankind approaches a state where mutual annihilation becomes a possibility. No other fact of today's world equals this in importance. It colors everything we say, everything we plan and everything we do. There is demanded of us vigilance, determination, and the dedication of whatever portion of our resources may be needed to provide adequate security, especially to provide a real deterrent to aggression. These things we are doing. And these facts emphasize the importance of striving incessantly for a just peace. Only through the strengthening of the spiritual, intellectual, economic, and defensive resources of the free world can we, in confidence, make progress toward this goal. Second, we note that recent Soviet deportment and pronouncements suggest the possible opening of a somewhat less strained period in relationships between the Soviet Union and the rest of the world. If these pronouncements be genuine, there is brighter hope of diminishing the intensity of past rivalry and eventually of substituting persuasion for coercion. Whether this is to become an era of lasting promise remains to be tested by actions. Third, we now stand in the vestibule of a vast new technological age, one that, despite its capacity for human destruction, has an equal capacity to make poverty and human misery obsolete. Over the past year, the Soviet Union has expressed interest in measures to reduce the common perils of war. While neither we nor any other free world nation can permit ourselves to be misled by pleasant promises until tested by performance, yet we approach this apparently new opportunity with the utmost seriousness. We must strive to break the calamitous cycle of frustrations and crises, which, if unchecked, could spiral into a nuclear disaster, the ultimate insanity. Though the need for dependable agreements to assure against resort to force in settling disputes is apparent to both sides, yet as in the other issues dividing men and nations, we cannot expect sudden and revolutionary results. But we must find some place to begin. One obvious road on which to make a useful start is in the widening of communication between our two peoples. In this field, there are, both sides willing, countless opportunities for developing mutual understanding, the true foundation of peace. Another avenue may be through the reopening of, on January 12th, of negotiations looking to a controlled ban on the testing of nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, the closing statement from the Soviet scientists who met with our scientists at Geneva gives the clear impression that their conclusions have been politically guided. Those of the British and American scientific representatives are their own freely formed individual and collective opinions. I am hopeful that as new negotiations begin, truth, not political opportunity, will guide the deliberations. Still another field may be found in the field of disarmament, in which the Soviets have professed a readiness to negotiate seriously. They have not, however, made clear the plans they may have, if any, for mutual inspection and verification, the essential condition for any extensive measure of disarmament. There is one instance where our initiative for peace has recently been successful. A multilateral treaty signed last month provides for the exclusively peaceful use of Antarctica, assured by a system of inspection. It provides for free and cooperative scientific research in that continent and prohibits nuclear explosions there, pending general international agreement on the subject. I shall transmit its text to the Senate for consideration and approval in the near future. The United States is always ready to participate with the Soviets in serious discussions on these or any other subjects that may lead to peace with justice. Certainly, it is not necessary to repeat that the United States has no intention of interfering with the internal affairs of any nation. By the same token, we reject any Soviet attempt to impose its system on us or other peoples by force or subversion. Now, this concern for the freedom of other peoples is the intellectual and spiritual cement which has allied us with more than 40 other nations in a common defense effort. Not for a moment do we forget that our own fate is firmly fastened to that of these countries. We will not act in any way which would jeopardize our solemn commitments to them. We and our friends are, of course, concerned with self-defense. Growing out of this concern is the realization that all people of the free world have a great stake in the progress in freedom of the uncommitted and newly emerging nations. These people, desperately hoping to lift themselves to decent levels of living, must not, by our neglect, be forced to seek help from and finally become virtual satellites of those who proclaim their hostility to freedom. But they must have technical and investment assistance. This is a problem to be solved not by America alone, but also by every nation cherishing the same ideals and in position to provide help. In recent years, America's partners and friends in Western Europe and Japan have made great economic progress. The international economy of 1960 is markedly different from that of the early post-war years. No longer is the United States the only major industrial country capable of providing substantial amounts of the resources so urgently needed in the newly developing countries. To remain secure and prosperous themselves, wealthy nations must extend the kind of cooperation to the less fortunate members that will inspire hope, confidence, and progress. A rich nation can, for a time, without noticeable damage to itself, pursue a course of self-indulgence, making its single goal the material ease and comforts of its own citizens, thus repudiating its own spiritual and material state in a peaceful and prosperous society of nations. But the enmities it will incur, the isolation into which it will descend, and the internal moral and spiritual softness that will be engendered will in the long term bring it to economic and political disaster. America did not become great through softness and self-indulgence. Her miraculous progress and material achievements flow from other qualities far more worthy and substantial. Adherence to principles and methods, consonance with our religious philosophy, a satisfaction in hard work, the readiness to sacrifice for worthwhile causes, the courage to meet every challenge, the intellectual honesty and capacity to recognize the true path of her own best interests. To us and to every nation of the free world, rich or poor, these qualities are necessary today as never before, if we are to march together to greater security, prosperity, and peace. I believe that the industrial countries are ready to participate actively in supplementing the efforts of the developing nations to achieve progress. The immediate need for this kind of cooperation is underscored by the strain in this nation's international balance of payments. Our surplus from foreign business transactions has in recent years fallen substantially short of the expenditures we make abroad to maintain our military establishments overseas, to finance private investment, and to provide assistance to the less developed nations. In 1959, our deficit in balance of payments approached $4 billion. Continuing deficits of anything like this magnitude would, over time, impair our own economic growth and check the forward progress of the free world. We must meet this situation by promoting a rising volume of export and world trade. Further, we must induce all industrialized nations of the free world to work together to help lift the scourge of poverty from those less fortunate. Cooperation in this matter will provide both for the necessary sharing of this burden and in bringing about still further increases in mutually profitable trade. New nations and others struggling with the problems of development will progress only, regardless of any outside help, if they demonstrate faith in their own destiny and use their own resources to fulfill it. Moreover, progress in the national transformation can be only gradually earned. There is no easy and quick way to follow from the ox cart to the jet plane. But just as we drew on Europe for assistance in our earlier years, so now do these new and emerging nations that do have this faith and this determination deserve help. Respecting their need, one of the major focal points of our concern is the South Asian region. Here, in two nations alone are almost 500 million people, all working and working hard to raise their standards and in doing so, to make of themselves a strong bulwark against the spread of an ideology that would destroy liberty. I cannot express to you the depth of my conviction that in our own and free world interest, we must cooperate with others to help these people achieve their legitimate ambitions as expressed in their different multi-year plans. Through the World Bank and other instrumentalities, as well as through individual action by every nation in position to help, we must squarely face this titanic challenge. I shall continue to urge the American people, in the interest of their own security, prosperity, and peace, to make sure that their own part of this great project be amply, and cheerfully supported. Free world decisions in this matter may spell the difference between world disaster and world progress in freedom. Other countries, some of which I visited last month, have similar needs. A common meeting ground is desirable for those nations which are prepared to assist in the development effort. During the past year, I have discussed this need with the leaders of several Western nations. Because of its wealth of experience, the Organization for European Economic Cooperation could help with the initial studies needed. The goal is to enlist all available economic resources in the industrialized free world, especially private investment capital. By extending this help, we hope to make possible the enthusiastic enrollment of these nations under freedom's banner. No more startling contrast to a system of sullen satellites could be imagined. If we grasp this opportunity to build an age of productive partnership between the less fortunate nations and those that have already achieved a high state of economic advancement, we will make brighter the outlook for a world order based upon security and freedom. Otherwise, the outlook could be dark indeed. We face, indeed, what may be a turning point in history. We must act decisively and wisely. As a nation, we can successfully pursue these objectives only from a position of broadly based strength. No matter how earnest is our quest for guaranteed peace, we must maintain a high degree of military effectiveness at the same time we are engaged in negotiating the issue of arms reduction. Until tangible and mutually enforceable arms reduction measures are worked out, we will not weaken, of course, the means of defending our institutions. America possesses enormous defensive power. It is my studied conviction that no nation will ever risk general war against us unless we should become so foolish as to neglect the defense forces we now so powerfully support. It is worldwide knowledge that any power which might be tempted today to attack the United States by surprise, even though we might sustain great losses, would itself promptly suffer a terrible destruction. But I once again assure all peoples and all nations that the United States, except in defense, will never turn loose this destructive power. During the past year, our long-range striking power, unmatched today in manned bombers, has taken on new strength as the Atlas Intercontinental Ballistic Missile has entered the operational inventory. In 14 recent test launches, at ranges of 5,000 miles, Atlas has been striking on an average within 2 miles of the target. This is less than the length of a jet runway, well within the circle of destruction. Incidentally, there was an Atlas firing last night. From all reports so far received, its performance conformed to the high standard I've just described. Such performance is a great tribute to American scientists and engineers who in the past 5 years have had to telescope time and technology to develop these long-range ballistic missiles where America had none before. This year, moreover, growing numbers of nuclear-powered submarines will enter our active forces, some to be armed with Polaris missiles. These remarkable ships and weapons, ranging the ocean, will be capable of accurate fire on targets virtually anywhere on Earth. To meet situations of less than general nuclear war, we continue to maintain our carrier forces. Our many service units abroad are always ready armed Army Strategic Forces and Marine Corps divisions, and the civilian components. The continuing modernization of these forces is a costly but necessary process. It is scheduled to go forward at a rate which will steadily add to our strength. The deployment of a portion of these forces beyond our shores demonstrates our determination to stand shoulder to shoulder with our allies for collective security. Moreover, I have directed the steps be taken to program, on a longer-range basis, our military assistance to these allies. This is necessary for a sounder collective defense system. Next, I refer to our program in space exploration, which is often mistakenly supposed to be an integral part of defense research and development. We note that, first, America has already made great contributions in the past 2 years to the world's fund of knowledge of astrophysics and space science. These discoveries are of present interest chiefly to the scientific community, but they are important foundation stones for more extensive exploration of outer space for the ultimate benefit of all mankind. Second, our military missile program, going forward so successfully, does not suffer from our present lack of very large rocket engines, which are necessary in distant space exploration. I am assured by experts that the thrust of our present missiles is fully adequate for defense requirements. Third, the United States is pressing forward in the development of large rocket engines to place vehicles of many tons into space for exploration purposes. Fourth, in the meantime, it is necessary to remember that we have only begun to probe the environment immediately surrounding the Earth. Using launch systems presently available, we are developing satellites to scout the Earth's weather, satellite relay stations to facilitate and extend communications over the globe, for navigation aids to give accurate bearings to ships and aircraft, and for perfecting instruments to collect and transmit the data we seek. Fifth, we have just completed a year's experience with our new space law. I believe it deficient in certain particulars. Suggested improvements will be submitted to the Congress shortly. The accomplishment of the many tasks I have alluded to requires the continuous strengthening of the spiritual, intellectual, and economic sinews of American life. The steady purpose of our society is to assure justice before God for every individual. We must be ever alert that freedom does not wither through the careless amassing of restrictive controls or the lack of courage to deal boldly with the issues of the day. A year ago, when I met with you, the nation was emerging from an economic downturn, even though the signs of resurgent prosperity were not then convincing to the doubtful. Today, our surging strength is apparent to everyone. 1960 promises to be the most prosperous year in our history. Yet we continue to be afflicted by nagging disorders. Among current problems that require solutions participated in by citizens as well as government are the need to protect the public interest in situation of prolonged labor management stalemate, a persistent refusal to come to grips with a critical problem in one sector of American agriculture, the continuing threat of inflation, together with a persisting tendency toward fiscal irresponsibility, in certain instances, the denial to some of our citizens of equal protection of the law. Every American was deeply disturbed by the prolonged dispute in the steel industry and by the protracted delay in reaching a settlement. We are all relieved that a settlement has at last been achieved in that industry. Percentage-wise, by this settlement, the increase to the steel companies in employment costs is lower than in any prior wage settlement since World War II. It is also gratifying to note that despite the increase in wages and benefits, several of the major steel producers have announced that there will be no increase in steel prices at this time. The national interest demands that in the period of industrial peace, which has been assured by the new contract, both management and labor make every possible effort to increase efficiency and productivity in the manufacture of steel so that price increases can be avoided. Well, one of the sharp lessons in this story is that the potential danger to the entire nation of longer and greater strikes must be met. To ensure against such possibilities, we must, of course, depend primarily upon the good common sense of the responsible individuals. It is my intention to encourage regular discussions between management and labor outside the bargaining table arena to consider the interests of the public as well as their own mutual interests in, first, the maintenance of industrial peace, price stability, incentives for continuous investment, and economic growth. Both the executive and the Congress will, I know, be watching developments with the keenest interest. To me, it seems almost absurd that the United States should recognize the need for and so earnestly to seek cooperation among the nations unless we can achieve voluntary, dependable, abiding cooperation among the important segments of our own free society. Without such cooperation, we cannot prosper. Failure to face up to basic issues in areas other than those of labor management can cause serious strains in our society. Agriculture is one of these areas. Our basic farm laws were written 27 years ago in an emergency effort to redress hardship caused by a worldwide depression. They were continued and their economic distortions intensified during World War II in order to provide incentives for production of food needed to sustain a war-torn world. Today, our farm problem is totally different. It is that of effectively adjusting to the changes caused by a scientific revolution. When the original farm laws were written, an hours farm law produced only one-fourth as much wheat as the same labor does today. Farm legislation is woefully out of date, ineffective, and expensive. For years, we have gone on with an outmoded system which not only has failed to protect farm income, but has produced soaring, threatening surpluses. Our farms have been left producing for war, while America has long been at peace. Once again, I urge Congress to enact legislation that will gear production more closely to markets, make costly surpluses more manageable, provide greater freedom in farm operations, and steadily achieve increased net farm incomes. Another issue that we must meet squarely is that of living within our means. This requires restraint in expenditure, constant reassessment of priorities, and the maintenance of stable prices. To do so, we must prevent inflation. Here is an opponent of many guises, so many guises, that it is sometimes difficult to recognize. But our clear need is to stop continuous and general price rises, a need that all of us can see and feel. To prevent steadily rising costs and prices calls for stern self-discipline by every citizen. No person, city, state, or organized group can afford to evade the obligation to resist inflation, for every single American pays its crippling tax. Increases in prices of the goods we sell abroad threaten to drive us out of markets that once were securely ours. Whether domestic prices, so high as to be non-competitive, result from demands for too high profit margins or from increased labor costs that outrun growth in productivity, the final result is seriously damaging to the nation. We must fight inflation as we would fight a fire that imperils our home. Only by so doing can we prevent it from destroying our savings, pensions, and insurance, and from gnawing away the very roots of a free, healthy economy and the nation's security. One major method by which the federal government can counter rising prices is to ensure that its own expenditures are below its revenues. The debt with which we are now confronted is about $290 billion, with interest charges alone now costing taxpayers about $9.5 billion each year. It is clear that this debt growth must stop. You will be glad to know that despite the unsettling influences of the recent steel strike, we estimate that our accounts will show on June 30th this year a favorable balance of approximately $200 million. Beyond this, I shall present to the Congress for 1961 a balanced budget. It provides that in the area of defense, expenditures will continue at record peacetime levels. With a single exception, expenditures in every major category of health, education, and welfare will be equal or greater than those of last year. In space expenditures, the amounts are practically doubled. But the overall guiding goal of this budget is national need, not response to specific group, local, or political insistence. Expenditure increases, other than those I have indicated, are largely accounted for by the increased cost of legislation previously enacted. I repeat, This budget will be a balanced one. The expenditures will be $79,800,000,000. The amount of income over outgo, described in the budget as a surplus, to be applied against our national debt, is $4,200,000,000. Personally, I do not feel that any amount can be properly called a surplus as long as the nation is in debt. I prefer to think of such an item as reduction on our children's inherited mortgage. And once we have established such payments as normal practice, we can profitably make improvements in our tax structure and thereby truly reduce the heavy burdens of taxation. In any event, this one reduction will save taxpayers each year approximately $200 million in interest costs. This favorable balance will ease pressures on our credit and capital markets. It will enhance the confidence of people all over the world in the strength of our economy and our currency. In the management of the huge public debt, the Treasury is, unfortunately, not free of artificial barriers. Its ability to deal with the difficult problems in this field has been weakened greatly by the unwillingness of the Congress to remove archaic restrictions. The need for a freer hand in debt management is even more urgent today, because the cost of the undesirable financing measures which the Treasury has been forced into are steadily mounting. Removal of this roadblock has high priority in my legislative recommendations. Still another issue relates to civil rights. In all our hopes and plans for a better world, we all recognize that provincial and racial prejudices must be combated. In the long perspective of history, the right to vote has been one of the strongest pillars of any free society. Our first duty is to protect this right against all encroachment. In spite of constitutional guarantees, and notwithstanding much progress of recent years, bias still deprives some persons in this country of equal protection of the law. Early in your last session, I recommended legislation which would help eliminate several practices discriminating against the basic rights of Americans. The Civil Rights Commission has developed additional constructive recommendations. I hope that these will be among the matters to be seriously considered in the current session. I trust that Congress will thus signal to the world that our government is striving for equality under law for all our people. Each year, and in many ways, our nation continues to undergo profound change and growth. In the past 18 months, we have hailed the entry of two more states of the Union, Alaska and Hawaii. We proudly salute these two new Western stars. Our vigorous expansion, which we all welcome as a sign of health and vitality, is many-sided. We are, for example, witnessing explosive growth in metropolitan areas. The roster of urban problems with which they must cope is staggering. They involve water supply, cleaning the air, adjusting local tax systems, providing for essential educational, cultural, and social services, and destroying those conditions which breed delinquency and crime. In meeting these, we must, if we value our historic freedoms, keep within the traditional framework of our federal system, with powers divided between national and state governments. I do not doubt that our urban and other perplexing problems can be solved in the traditional American method. In doing so, we must realize that nothing is really solved. Indeed, ruinous tendencies are set in motion by yielding to the deceptive bait of the easy federal tax dollar. Our educational system provides a ready example. We cannot be complacent about educating our youth. All recognize the vital necessity for modern school plants and well-qualified and adequately compensated teachers. But the route to better trained mind is not through the swift administration of a federal hypodermic or even sustained financial transfusion. The educational process, essentially a local and personal responsibility, cannot be made to leap ahead by crash centralized governmental action. The administration has proposed a carefully reasoned plan for helping eliminate current deficiencies. It is designed to stimulate such things as classroom construction, not by substituting of federal dollars for state and local funds, but by incentives to extend and encourage state and local efforts. This approach rejects the notion of federal domination or control. It is workable and should appeal to every American interested in the advancement of our educational system in the traditional American way. I urge the Congress to take in action upon this plan. There is one other subject concerning which I renew a recommendation I made in my State of the Union message last January. I then advised the Congress of my purpose to intensify our efforts to to replace force with a rule of law among nations. That purpose is widely and deeply shared by many other people and nations of the world. In the same message, I stated that our efforts would include a re-examination of our own relation to the International Court of Justice. The court was established to decide international legal disputes between nations. In 1946, we accepted the court's jurisdiction, but subject to a reservation of the right to determine unilaterally whether a matter relies essentially within domestic jurisdiction. There is pending before the Senate the resolution which would repeal our present self-judging reservation. I support that resolution and urge its prompt passage. If this is done, I intend to urge similar acceptance of the court's jurisdiction by every member of the United Nations. Here, perhaps, it is not amiss for me to say a personal word to the members of the Congress in this, my final year of office. I am not unique as a president who has worked with a Congress controlled by the opposition party, except that no other president ever did it quite so long. Yet in both personal and official relationships, we have weathered all the storms of the past 5 years, and for this I am deeply grateful. My deep concern in the next 12 months, before my successor takes office, is with our joint congressional executive duty to our own and to other nations. Acting upon the beliefs I have expressed here today, I shall devote my full energy to the task at hand. Presumably, this will involve travel for promoting greater world understanding, negotiations to reduce international discord, constant discussions and communications with the Congress and the American people to settle issues, both domestic and foreign. In pursuit of these objectives, I look forward to and rededicate myself to a close and constructive association with the Congress. We seek a common goal, brighter opportunity for our own citizens, and a world peace with justice for all. Before us and our friends is the challenge of an ideology which, for more than four decades, has trumpeted abroad its purpose of gaining ultimate victory over all forms of government at variance with its own. We realize that however much we repudiate the tenets of imperialistic communism, it represents a gigantic enterprise. Its leaders compel its subjects to subordinate their freedom of action and spirit and personal desires in favor of some hoped-for advantage in the future. And the communists can present an array of material accomplishments over the past 15 years that lends a false persuasiveness to many of their glittering promises to the uncommitted people. The competition they provide is formidable. We so recognize it. But in our scale of values, we place freedom first. Our whole national development. Our whole national development has been geared to that basic concept and is responsible for the position of free world leadership to which we have succeeded. Freedom is the highest prize that any nation can possess. It is one that communism can never offer. And America's record of material accomplishment in freedom is written not only in the unparalleled prosperity of our own nation. It is found also in the many billions we have devoted to the reconstruction of free world economies wrecked by World War II, and in the effective help provided by the many more billions we have given in saving the independence of numerous others threatened by outside domination. Assuredly, we have the capacity for handling the problems in the new era of the world's history we are now entering. But we must use that capacity intelligently, tirelessly, and regardless of personal sacrifice. The fissure that divides our political planet is deep and wide. We live, moreover, in a storm of semantic disorder in which old labels no longer faithfully describe. Police states are called people's democracies. Armed conquest of free peoples is called liberation. Such slippery slogans make difficult the problem of communicating true faith, facts, and beliefs. We must make clear our peaceful intentions, our aspirations for a better world. To do so, we must use language to enlighten the mind, not as the instrument of the studied innuendo and distorter of truth. And we must live by what we say. As a nation, we take pride that our own constitutional system and the ideals which sustain it have been long viewed elsewhere as a fountainhead of freedom. By our every word and action, we must strive to make ourselves worthy of this trust, ever mindful that an accumulation of seemingly minor encroachments upon freedom gradually could break down the entire fabric of a free society. So persuaded, we shall get on with the task before us. So dedicated and with faith in the Almighty, humanity shall one day achieve the unity and freedom to which all men have aspired from the dawn of time. Thank you very much.
President Eisenhower's annual State of the Union address lasted more than 45 minutes, was interrupted by applause on more than 30 occasions. We have presented the annual State of the Union address by the President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who spoke to a joint session of Congress. This special program came to you from the chamber of the House of Representatives here in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C.